I had this feeling over the last few days that I may have bit off more than I can chew for today's shiur. So what we'll do is we're going to do as much as we can, and most probably there's enough information left over for another few shiurim in the years to come. In Parashas Shoftim, and you have it as number one, we have Parashat HaMelech. There is the parasha of appointing a king. Ki tavol haaretz. Let's run through the psukim quickly. When you come to the land asher Hashem lokecha notein lach, that God gives you v'yirishta v'yarshafta ba, you will inherit the land and settle it. V'amarta. How do you translate v'amarta? Everybody's frightened. You think it's a trick question. And you will say? Could it also mean and you shall say? All right? Va'amarta. The word va'amarta is going to be pivotal. Extremely significant. And the significance of the word va'amarta is such that its ramifications can be felt ad hayom hazeh. It affects us until today and will continue to affect us in the future. Now that I've made one of these great broad statements and you're wondering what in heaven's name am I talking about, so now I have the rest of the shiur to explain how pivotal and how so much depends on the word v'amarta and how and the way in which it's translated. Anyway, you're going to say, you will say, or you shall say, Osima alai melech, I want to place upon myself a king, kechol hagoyim asher svivotai, like all of the nations around me. Now, that can sound good, and it can also sound bad. It may very well reflect the idea that I see nations that have kings, and there's order, and there's justice, no chaos, no anarchy. They seem to have solid leadership, people loyal to the king. Well, I would like something of that sort. It can also be something very negative. We have to learn from the goyim? I want a king like all the goyim around me. Dus felt menach, you understand? As though we're not capable of running a government of our own, but we're going to learn, you understand, from Syria and Iraq and Lebanon and Jordan and Egypt. You know, we're going to learn. I want to have a leader. Or the Palestinian Authority, you understand. Will the real leader of the Palestinian Authority please stand up? Who is it? Abu Shmabu, Arafat Hin, Dahlan, Jibril Rejub, I mean, real. I want a king like all the people around me. So the mitzvah is the following. You shall place upon yourself a king. There is a condition. The condition is, yes, you will place upon yourself a king, but the choice is going to be God's. The man who will serve as king, God chooses. What does Som Tosim Alecha, that you shall place upon you, upon yourself? So the Gemara says, Shetehei Eimato Alecha, fear of him shall be upon you. You should appoint him in concert with God, but you have to know, you have a king, you have to respect, revere, and fear him. Mikerev Achecha Tosim Alecha Melech, from amongst your brothers you shall place upon yourself a king. Lo tuchal latet alecha ish nachri asher lo achicha, who you cannot place upon yourself a stranger who is not from your brothers. For those of you who were at last week's shiur, we talked about the meaning of the word lo tuchal, or because the word lo tuchal means you can't do it. What do you mean you can't do it? Of course we can. We can do anything we want to do. But that there's a unique meaning to the word lo tuchal. And just, if you weren't here last week, you'll just have to suffer by not knowing it. There are five places. We said that there are five places in Sefer Dvarim, and in no other place, in no other Chumash, five mitzvahs where it says, lo tuchal, you cannot. And in each case we ask the question, but of course we can. Didn't anybody teach Moshe Rabbeinu the difference between can and may? Every one of us was taught that when we were 5 years old, 6 years old. There's a difference between can and may. So we explained that Moshe Rabbeinu was speaking to a people whom he has brought to the level or wants to bring them to the level that there are certain things that even if they can do it, they will choose not to do it. No, I can't do it. I can't be Nechal Shabbos. I can't eat treif. But I can. Of course I can. But I can't. I can't. Anyway, Dach lo yar v'lo susim, he shouldn't have too many horses. V'lo yoshev et ha'al mitzrayimo, in order that he should not bring the people back to Egypt. L'man harbot sus, in order to have many horses. V'ashem amalachem, and God has said to you, lo tosifim lo shuv baderech hazeh od. God has told you, you're not permitted to return. Go back to Mitzrayim the way that you came out of it. So you can't have too many horses because horses came from Mitzrayim. V'lo yar v'lo noshim, v'lo yosu levavo, he shouldn't have too many wives so that they shouldn't turn his heart away. V'chesed v'zo v'lo yar v'lo miyod, you shouldn't have silver and gold. When he sits upon his throne, he shall write this Mishnah Torah. Gemara really says that he's supposed to write a whole Sefer Torah. More than that, Gemara says that a halacha is that a king had two Sefer Torah, one that he kept at home, and there was one that was always with him, a small Sefer Torah. Wherever the king went, he had a Sefer Torah there to remind him of his obligations and responsibilities. He's not a monarch who has the right to do whatever he chooses to do. Everything has to be tempered according to the laws of Torah. Al Seifim lifnei ha-kohanim al-levim, there was a Sefer Torah in the Bet HaMikdash, one of the 13 Sifrei Torah that Moshe Rabbeinu wrote. And all Sifrei Torah were checked by that. That was the standard. The standard. What is it? Is it in Washington that they have something that is a foot, an inches, that is the standard? Remember, I lived in Canada, so there was some place where they had the meter. There's a Sefer Torah that was the one with it, to which all Sefer Torah were checked. All right, let's go for it. V'haytayimo, it shall be with him, the korabo koyamei chayov, and he should read it all the days of his life. L'man yilmad li'yira et Hashem l'kof, so that he should learn to fear God, his God. L'shvar et kol divei ha-Torah azot, to keep all of the words of this Torah. V'tachukim ha'ela la'asotam, all of these laws to do them. L'viltirum l'vavo me'echov, that his heart should not rise in pride above his brothers. U'l'viltisur min ha-mitzvah, yaminu smal, he shouldn't turn away from the commandments of God to the right or to the left. That he and his children shall have length of days in their royal reign amongst the children of Israel. Okay. On the other side, and I want you to follow me, we're going to move through this quickly. This is a Gemara in Masechet Sanhedrin. And you have it there, you really have it with the English translation. Very important Gemara. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel. Rav Yehuda said in the name of Shmuel, Kol ha'omer b'parashat Melech, Melech mutabo. Whatever is said in the parasha of the king, and when they're talking about the parasha of the king over here, we just have to go ahead in history to the days of Shmuel, the prophet Shmuel. It was in his days, more than 300 years after the Jews had come into Eretz Israel, that they came to him and they said, we want a king to judge us like all of the nations around us. Shmuel was very upset with them that they asked for a king. He felt it as a rejection of himself. And the fact is that in the period of Shmuel, Jews had it better than all of the years of the Shoftim of the judges. Shmuel was the one who finally united all of the people of Israel, to the point, of course, where they're now able to turn to one man to assist them in their search for a king. and they reject him. God says to Shmuel, don't be upset. Lo otcha ma'asu, it's not you whom they have rejected. Oti ma'asu, they've rejected me from being king upon them. If they would be truly pious, then they don't need more than the Rabbeinu Shel Olam and any Navi or prophet whom he sends. You don't need anything else. Anyway, the final thing is that Hashem says, I'm going to choose. And the one that he chooses is Shaul ben Kish, the first king. Shmuel gathers the entire people together and he tells them what the powers of a king are. He can take your sons and daughters to work for him. He can tax your produce of the field. He can take your sheep and your cattle. I mean, he lists over there. You can get frightened and terrified of what the powers of a king are. The question is, do those powers belong to the king by right or not? Take a look. Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Rabbi Yehuda in the name of Shmuel says, Kol ha'amor v'parashat melech, every power that was enumerated in the portion of the king, and he's referring to what Shmuel tells the people. It's not Parsha Shoftim. So Shmuel says, Shmuel the Amora, the rabbi says, Melech mutabo, the king is permitted to do that, yes. He can take sons and daughters for his army, for the service of his government. Rav Amar lo nemra parsha zu el alayim aleim, the whole parsha was only in order to frighten them, to threaten them, that they better know what they're getting themselves into. But a king does not have the right indiscriminately to take for his service anybody whom he chooses. Shenema, son tosim alecha melech, you shall surely place a king upon you. This is the Gemara that I had mentioned to you. Shetehe emato alecha. Shmuel wanted to make sure that they're going to be afraid of their king. They have to know that's the only way a king can succeed. Now the Gemara says the following. Katanoi, this is also a dispute between Tanoim. Rabbi Yossi says, Kol ha'omer b'parashas melech, whatever is said in the parasha of the king, melech mutar bo, a king is indeed permitted to do so. And Rabbi Yehuda says, lo nemra parashasu elekedei la'ayim aleim, this is a repeat of the difference of opinion that we had between the Amoraim. And now the Gemara says that this difference of opinion already existed in the days of Tanoim, that was years earlier. Either the king is permitted indeed to do what it was that Shmuel told the people, or that he really doesn't have the right to indiscriminately take people, conscript people into his service. But Shmuel wanted them to know that you have to have fear for the king. Now, here it begins getting even more exciting. V'chein ha'yeh Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda said, Shalosh mitzvot nitztavu Yisrael b'knisatam la'aretz. And the Rambam paskens is, Jews were commanded three mitzvot when they came in to Eretz Yisrael. The first was l'ha'amid lehem melech, to appoint upon themselves a king, u'l'achrid zaro shel Amalek, and to destroy the children of Amalek, v'livnot lehem beit ha'bechidan, to build a Beit HaMikdash. These are the three mitzvahs in that order. Rabbi Yehuda therefore is saying there was a mitzvah that they were commanded to perform when they came into Eretz Yisrael. Question, of course, would be, why did it take 300 years? Why did it take 300 years? Obviously, we must say that it takes 300 years because the people has to be ready for it. People have to be ready for it. To say that we want a king, and as I pointed out, there had to be a unity of the Jewish people in order to ask for a king. Now, the first time that there's a sense of unity, and it's not complete yet, is when Shmuel becomes prophet, because it says that all of Israel, from Dan until Beersheba, they all saw Shmuel as a prophet of God. There hadn't been one person since Yehoshua, there wasn't one person to whom all of Israel looked. During the period of the judges, each judge was really localized in a particular area. There was no one shofet who judged all of Israel. Dvorah and Baruch ben Avinoam were in the Galil HaTachton and part of the Galil HaElyon. Shimshon was Dan and Yehuda. Gidon was Ephraim and Menashe. I mean, there were localized powers to the Shoftim, but there was nobody who embraced all of Israel. And the first one was Shmuel. And as I said, that's why Shmuel was the one who was able to carry out the plan for a king. So there were three mitzvahs, but there are certain mitzvahs that you have to wait for the moment. Maybe that's what the Torah means when the Torah says V'omarta, and you will say. Maybe God is hinting that you have to wait until the Jewish people say it. You can't impose a form of government on them from above. That form of government is something that a people need to want for it to succeed. Yes. The only problem is they're going to be condemned so roundly for having asked for a king that I have no way to find a pshat. I mean, it's very nice that you're trying to say that this was spoke very well of the Jewish people, even though you're partially right. I don't remember. The Gemara is going to say it here. Zekenim Shebohem, the elders who came to Shmuel to ask for a king, asked properly. And you know what their properly was? Exactly what you had in mind. We have finally sensed a figure who rallies around him all of Israel. We want something like this. Zekenim Shebohem, the Gemara is going to say, asked correctly. The youth or the younger ones, they just wanted a king k'chol ha'goyim. Watch, let's see the Gemara. So, v'chein hoya Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Rabbi Yehuda said, three mitzvahs Jews were commanded when they came into Eretz Yisrael to appoint a king to destroy the seed of Amalek, to build a Bet HaMikdash, and we will indeed see one of the first mitzvot that Shmuel commands Shaul is to destroy Amalek. And Shmuel, in fact, fails. Shaul fails. Good. I love when you correct me like that. I need to be kept in line. Shaul fails in that undertaking. Rav Nahoroi Omer, this is a famous machlokes, Rav Yehuda and Rav Nahoroi. Rav Nahoroi Omer, lo nemra parsha zu elo keneget tar umatan. This passage where the Torah says, V'omarto, you shall place a king, was said only in response to the nation's complaint. Now, you want a king? Okay, have your king. Do you know what emerges from this machlokas between Rabbi Yehuda and Rav Nahoroi? It all depends on how you read the word v'omarto. Rabbi Yehuda says it's a mitzvah to appoint a king. So you know how he reads v'omarto? And you shall say, you should say, give me a king. Rav Nahoroi says, no, the whole idea of having a king is not something that God wants in the first instance. But v'omarta, you're going to say, you will say. No, if you're going to say you want a king, so what will we do? So we're going to give you your king. Take your king and see how good it is. By the way, this has nothing to do with the idea of a Melech HaMashiach. Melech HaMashiach is something that simply doesn't enter into the picture over here. Then we're going to be talking about a period of time in history. Kimolo Ha'oretz Deyot Hashem. The world is going to be full of the knowledge of God. Kamayim Layam Nechasim. As the waters cover the seas. It's going to be a time that Lo Yiso Goyel Goy Cherev. No nation will lift up sword against the nation. Lo yilmedu ol milchama, they're not going to wage war anymore. The Melech HaMashiach is going to be not only an executive leader, he is going to be a great spiritual force in the whole world. That's a completely different kind of story. There will most probably be functionaries in every country that are going to run the affairs of state. But that's not the kind of malchus we're talking about. So here we have the machloket, Rav Yehuda and Rav Nehorai. Rav Yehuda says it's a mitzvah, which means your martyr, you should say, that's what we want you to do. You have to ask for a king. We're going to wait until you ask. And Rav Nehorai says, you're going to ask. You're going to ask. And then you'll see what's going to be. Tanya, we learned in a braisa. Rabbi Eliezer says the kingdom of Ador Kahogan Shaolu, the elders of Shmuel's generation requested properly, Shenema, Tnolonu Melech Lishtoftenu, give us a king to judge us. Aval Amahi Oret Shebehen Kilkalu, but the boors among them ruined the request when they said, Bohayinu Gamanachnu Kachol Agoyim, we shall also be like all of the nations. Ushvatonu Malkenu, when our king will judge us, Vyotzol Ofanenu, and he shall go out before us. We're going to have basically a repetition where the Gemara is going to repeat the idea that there are three mitzvot, and the Gemara is going to explain how do we know the order of the mitzvot, but that doesn't concern us now. But the three mitzvot, and as I said, the Roman Paskin says, King, Amalek, and Bet HaBchira, Bet HaMikdash. The real topic of discussion today is going to be the following. What about a different form of government according to Torah? Let's make the question very practical. What about a democracy? Does a democracy have any place? Does a democracy have any place in Jewish life? We don't find, doesn't seem that we find any place that Torah speaks out on behalf of demokratia. I mean, there are those who have made who worship demokratia. The guys who speak most about demokratia, by the way, are the most undemocratic people of all. Don't ever forget that. The leftist protesteth too much when he says chok, law, and demokratia. Yes. All right, what you're saying is that some of the underpinnings of democracy do find their expression in Torah. For example, the pasuk in, you're referring to a pasuk in Mishpatim, Achrei Rabim Lahatos. You incline according to the majority. Yeah, but democracy is there's going to be a balanced approach here. The balanced approach is, it's clear that there are serious failings to a democracy. There are serious problems with democracy. Democracy may very well turn out to be the best form of government that we know of right now or available to us. But there are serious, serious problems. I've made notes on the faults of democracy. Well, you know, of course, that in a democracy, that they can vote the minority out of existence. By the way, this was understood at the very outset. What happens if the majority rules that we're going to exterminate the 49% minority? Majority rules, right? Is there anything wrong with that? Did anybody find anything wrong with that? Boy, nobody's talking today. You're scared of me today? What are you talking about? Can't the majority go ahead and just legislate the minority out of existence? Of course they can. Huh? They've got to the bagatz. That's the most undemocratic institution of all. When they read the riot act to King John, when was it? In the 12th century. So they understood at the very outset that a democracy can only survive if there's a bill of basic rights. You have to have a bill of rights. In other words, that there are certain things that the majority can't even vote upon. everybody has the right to protection and privacy, the pursuit of happiness. All people are created equal. In other words, there are basic rights, that inalienable rights that belong to everybody. Why is there a Bill of Rights? Because without a Bill of Rights, the majority can simply crush and destroy the minority, and they did it all fair, square, and legal. The problem of a democracy can very well be that people are going to put their trust, or maybe even worse, their faith in people who could later very well use the democracy to take it one step further and turn it into tyranny. And that has happened. Germany, of course, is the classic example. Hitler and Yimach Shemo came to power by a completely democratic process. What we're unaware of is how many of these two-bit tyrants have come to power in Africa over the last 40, 50 years, and we don't even have a count anymore how many people they have killed. How many battles? I tell you. We need the redcoats. They should bring the British back. All right? I can hear that. I mean, they were certainly better off in colonial days. Not here. Not here. But there's no question about it. Unfortunately, black is killing black in Europe until today, right now. Who knows how many thousands are being killed today? Every so often I try to learn the map of Africa. Now, in Europe I know a little bit, but Africa has changed so much. Germany is never still Germany, and France and Italy, it hasn't changed for 1,000 years. But in Africa, it's changing all of the time. Right. So you have to know the names of the places. There was even a time that I wanted to learn the president of each country in Africa, until I decided, you know, I'd better learn a Plat Gemara. It will be much more worthwhile to learn a Perek Tanakh Baal Peh. So first of all, there's the fear that the majority is going to inflict harm on the minority. It's also the problem that people will put their trust or faith in leaders who will later become tyrants, who will in turn divest the citizenry of all of the rights that they had, which brought the fellow to power in the first place. It's also possible that in a democracy, that the vested interests of the few may become the policy of that government. And it may be the kind of policy that will be destructive for the nation and even involve the nation in international conflict. This can happen in democracy. It has happened in democracies. What we're pointing out is the downside. There is a downside to democracy. There are certainly downsides to the democracy of in Israel today. Certainly downsides. And these guys, you should know, anybody who was born in the United States of America and lived in early years, they were growing up, they lived in the United States of America, knows more about democracy in their pinky finger than all of the G'dayli politicians over here in Guns and Cup. They don't have a clue. And the proof of it is the idea that it's really, we vote for blocks of parties. We don't vote for people. It's unheard of. It's absolutely unheard of. In West Hempstead on Long Island, when I called my local congressman, he jumped. I most probably got my local congressman to do more for Soviet Jewry than you can get out of a Haver Knesset. Because he knew that I control a large block of votes. He knew that he is responsible. There is not one single member of Knesset who owes his position to any particular riding. What a difference it would make. There's no responsibility. So, all right, so now they say there have to be primaries. So instead of 10 guys in a smoke-filled room deciding who's going to represent them in Knesset, so you have 100,000 fellows in a smoke-filled room. Wait a minute. Wait till I get to that. It's 10 years now. I just finished writing an article yesterday on the Cheshbon HaNefesh that we have to make 10 years after Oslo. Maybe that'll be a shiur in a week or two. The important? Yeah. So, all right. That was a classic example. One of the classic examples of all time of the perversion that can be done in the name of democracy. It was the most undemocratic thing that we didn't. We ran into the streets, but nobody listened to us. And all the fellows talking about democracy. I mean, everybody knows. If you don't remember these names, these are two names. Two names that you have to remember. The Dosan Vavicham we spoke talking about a lot, but Gonen Segev and Alex Goldfarb. Gonen Segev and Alex Goldfarb were elected to Knesset on an extreme right-wing ticket. And they were bought off to become numbers 59 and 60 so that they should be able to pass Oslo. Do you understand? The most classic perversion of democracy. And the guys, you know, the guys with the horn-rimmed glasses were walking around and saying, what? We passed Oslo democratically. What are you talking about? It was a blow at democracy. It's not the only. There were another blows. I remember the first Shabbos before the September 9th was Thursday, 1993, Friday, Shabbos in the morning. I got up and said, I don't know, how are they going to pull this off? How are they going to get this through Knesset? In any proper democracy, you'd need at least a 2/3 vote of Knesset. In the 30s, if you wanted to finally be able to drink a bishop schnapps legally, you needed not only 2/3 of Congress and Senate, but 2/3 of every state legislator of all the states. They understand what the process had been. And these guys got themselves a majority of one. And they changed dramatically the whole history of this people. And they created, the worst mistake in Jewish history. But it was democratic. Democracy can be destructive because you can manipulate a democracy. And there's a lot of manipulation of democracy here. Don't be wrong, I love this country. But the system, if there's no, long as there's not going to be directly elected officials, and I don't know why they went crazy, but what was the tragedy of a directly elected prime minister? It's just because it didn't work out good for the boys. Because Netanyahu got in, you understand? That was bad. But there's, it's unbelievable. Even more serious, and remember, we're looking at government from a religious point of view. Even more serious is the possibility that the majority can seriously affect the spiritual and cultural level of the country in an extremely negative way. We've been witness to that here. There have been major battles over here about legislation that is destructive to Yadut. So it's not so simple to say that, well, Torah is all for democracy. Democracy can be extremely in opposition to all Torah stands for. They may also take decisions that seriously compromise vital national interests. By the way, every sentence here is coming from a different tshuva. There have been hundreds that have been written about democracy and Torah. A democratic government may very well take decisions that seriously compromise vital national interests. And we're living through that right now. I saw one person who writes, it can cheapen promises, because in the course of a campaign, people are going to make all sorts of promises. that they never intend to keep. And it becomes a destruction of the spoken word. I remember sitting, most of the exciting things happened to me when I'm sitting at a bar mitzvah or a wedding. I was sitting at a wedding, and here is this frumer fellow from Hanov, but zwei linke Hand and zwei linke Fies, so leftist. Here's a whole table of right wingers, and he starts up with me. See how smart they are. Starts up with me, and it was at the time Barak. So I said, I don't understand. The man promised. I don't know, on a stack of haaretzes, he promised that Yerushalayim will remain forever united on the sovereignty of the state of Israel, and now he's negotiating with Arafat to divide Yerushalayim. So this fella looks at me and says, Michael, how naive can you get? That was a campaign promise. I said, what? You can stand for such immorality? He wasn't making a promise about whether there will be parking tickets or not parking tickets, or alternate side of the street parking in Yerushalayim. He was making a promise about the most significant issue in all of Jewish history. And you can just sit there and tell me, promises, promises. It's unbelievable that an intelligent person would say it. And I always thought that he was an intelligent person. Another negative, by the way, a number of these negative aspects of democracy come from somebody who would never have believed would say it. Lord Jacobowitz, Olav HaShalom. It was anti-democracy. He said that another terrible thing about a democracy is that in the course of a campaign, you know what's going to take place? What will be brought to the fore and exaggerated out of all proportion are those issues that divide us. There's a destructive effect to the whole campaign. That's probably, if you want to get a little frumer and you start talking about the Lashon Hara and the Rechilus and the Machlekes and the Sinas Chinam that's involved in a campaign, and here anything goes, not only anything goes, if you're the right party, you can bring in millions of dollars and never have to stand for judgment. Funnel it through all sorts. Boy, they should have all those guys sign those things we little fry had to sign before August 17th, you understand. They haven't brought up anybody for trial yet from the Barak campaign for all the money that came in. And I remember hearing Netanyahu a few days before that election, and he sort of said, we don't stand a chance. We're fighting hundreds of millions of shekels that have come in. I mean, I heard this at a campaign meeting. It was a campaign meeting for Rabbanim. We'll never win. On the outside, he kept up that face, until after the election, we're going to win. Why has nobody been brought to bar of justice? By the way, all of this is also part of the negative aspects. If you have the right people in the right place and you're well connected, you'll never come to trial. While everybody else will be brought to trial for crimes far less significant. Then there are bigger questions. How do you know the majority is right? How do you know the majority is right? In other words, democracy is all based on the fact that the majority is right. Is that? You're so sure? You're so sure the majority is right? How many times have you heard of polls that were taken, and you take a look at yourself, 72% of the people hold such and such, and you think to yourself, are they crazy? What's the guarantee that the majority knows what's best? Then there's another extremely important aspect. When you have a majority, how do you know that it's a real majority? It may very well be a coalition of interests, and they've joined together in order to knock other interests out of the box, and it doesn't really represent what the majority of people hold. Yes?
Oh. no, if you think you're going to get me into that, that's going to be a, that can be a separate shiur all of its own, and there's a great deal to be said about that. Don't even let the thought cross your mind for a moment that Shlomo HaMelech was anything less than what HaKadosh Baruch Hu said about him, that he is my Yedid, my best friend. He gave him the name Yedidya. So I'm just saying, keep your mind clear. Don't let anything invade it. I'll take care of that one of these days. Gesunde. By the way, shocking as it may be, there are opinions of rabbis who say that is it truly the best thing that everybody has the right to vote? Are there people maybe that shouldn't have the right to vote? I'm afraid to say it, but I'm going to say it. Whatever happens, worst comes to worst, we'll just throw out all the tapes. Reb Chaim David Alevi Zecher Tzadik Livracha, who was the Sephardi chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, he says it beferish, it's there in a tshuva. I saw it with my own eyes. He says that the only person who should be allowed to vote in an election is somebody who carries equal responsibility with everybody else for the affairs of state. He was a very big Talmud Chacham, wrote many Svarim, and his Svarim are in great use. And he says his prime example is anybody who doesn't go to the army should not be given the right to vote. If you're not ready to shoulder the responsibility of serving in the armed forces, then you can't vote. You're not part of the democracy. These are serious questions. These are halakhic questions. We're not talking politics today. We're talking halakhic questions. There are two great people who are completely opposed to democracy. I just feel bad that Rav Nachman Kahana walked out. I'll have to tell him upstairs later. His brother, Rav Meir Kahana, Hashem Yinkom Tamahu, and, in the same breath, Rav Elchanan Wasserman, Hashem Yinkom Tamahu, both said that democracy is absolutely anti-Torah. Meir Kahana brings, I have a sefer here with me, brings famous Gemara in Masechta Sanhedrin. We talked over the last few weeks about the city of Yerushalayim is surrounded by Sancheriv, the forces of Assyria. The city is about to fall into the hands of the Assyrians. Everybody thinks all hope is lost. And in the city itself, as it was with Jews, there are two groups in the city who are locked in struggle. Chizkiyahu is the king, and Shevna HaSofer. And Shevna HaSofer says, let's surrender the city to the king of Ashur. And Chizkiyahu says no. The king says no. And then Chizkiyahu is concerned, maybe even God isn't with him, because the majority were with Shevna. The majority said, let's surrender the city to the forces of Sancheriv. So Yeshayahu says that God appears to Chizkiyahu and he says, Lo tomrun keshe lechol ha'om hazeh. Don't be concerned about the conspiracy, because it's kesher reshoyim. It's a conspiracy of the evil. I'm with you and not with them. And of course we know what happened during the course of that night. And even before that night, Shevna went out to hand the keys of the city over to Sancheriv. And the Gemara describes that all of those who were behind him, as they're marching out of the city, they start dropping off. And in the end, there's only one who comes to Sancheriv, and that's Shevna. And he runs him through with 300 spears. So the Gemara is clearly saying, expression of God's will. Majority? Majority doesn't count. If the majority would count, maybe we should be Christians, maybe we should be something else. Majority doesn't count. He brings a lot of other proofs, by the way. So it means the following. In sum, what's important to know is democracy may not be the best system. It may very well be the best system we have. It also may be the system that if we work on improving it, we can turn it into a
a good system. The bigger question that we have to ask is, the Rambam paskins that there are three mitzvahs that we have to fulfill when we come into the land of Israel, and one is lemanot lehem melech, to appoint a king. How do we have a right to make a democracy when the mitzvah should be a king? So there is most probably the classic source of all is number three. It looks formidable, it's not formidable. It's the Netziv, Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, who was the last Hashiva of Volozhin. And everybody who talks about democracy and the Jewish state must deal or begins his discussion with the Netziv. It's a classic document. Vo'amarta. You know what he's going to say? He's going to say simply the following. We have a problem with this word vo'amarta. It could mean you should. It could mean you may. Now, do we have to have a king or don't we have to have a king? What does the Torah say? So he says, the Torah chose an ambivalent word. Why wasn't the Torah clear? Why does the Torah have to leave us with a word? Which, by the way, is not used by any other mitzvah in all of Torah. It could leave the impression as though it's all in our hands, it's up to us. Is it a mitzvah or is it up to us? So he says there's a very good reason why Torah used a word that can be understood in more than one way. Ein ha-perush amido kimashmo bepeh. First of all, he says the word v'yamarta doesn't mean you have to utter the words out of your mouth as some kind of formula. I want a king. Ela k'lishon v'yamarta och labasa. The pasuk says, you know, later that when you're going to come into Eretz Yisrael v'yamarta and you're going to think to yourself, you're going to contemplate that you want to eat meat. So there's a halacha that if it's kodshim, you have to bring it to the Beis HaMikdash, otherwise you have to shecht it. Ochen, lefi loshen zohar yevamash mishen zeh mitzvah b'muchlak, limanot melech, el rishut. That understanding of the word v'yamarta, therefore, seems to leave the impression that this is not an absolute commandment to appoint a king, but it's something that's optional. K'mo v'yamarta och labasa. Torah is not saying, you shall say you want to eat meat. If you want to eat meat, vada yadua b'divrei chazal, the mitzvah l'manot melech, he's asking the question. But our rabbi said that there's a mitzvah to appoint a king. We learned the Gemara. In Cain, l'maik tiv v'amarta, if it's a mitzvah, why does it say v'amarta, that this word that leaves us in some kind of a twilight zone, and we don't know whether it's obligatory, it's not obligatory. V'nida, so he says the following. Here's a classic formulation of a position. The way a country runs changes in mitnahei ha-pidat melucha or al-pidat ha-am v'nivchareyam. There's a difference between whether there's a king, there's a royal house, there's a monarchy, or the opinions of the people and their chosen ones. V'yesh medina sheni yecholel lisbol dat melucha. There are countries or groups of human beings that simply cannot tolerate the idea of a king. And there have been people in history, and there may even be people today, that without a king, they feel like a boat without a captain. This is the most important sense that he says. You cannot, even God, cannot impose a form of government on Klal Yisrael through a positive commandment. You must have this kind of government. It depends on the feelings of people. It depends on the time. It depends on the era. It depends on what's happening. There are so many factors that go into making up what kind of government should people have. Anything that has to do with the leadership of the people, nogeyala sakonas nefashis. The leadership of a country is something that involves grave danger to life. Shedoche mitzvah saseh, that sets aside positive commandments. Mishum hochi, because of this, lo efshel etzavos behechle, you cannot command in an absolute way, lemanot melech, to appoint a king, calls manchelo, ola bahaskamas ha'am, lizbol ol melech, as long as the people have not agreed that they are ready to accept upon themselves the yoke of a king.
al pisharoim, and why might they want to do this? Because if they see other countries around them who seem to be run in a far more efficient way, that they may want to try that. They see people around them who are conducting themselves in a way that's even better. Oh, Oz, then, if the people want it, then it's a mitzvah saseh le Sanhedrin, the man of Melech. It's a positive commandment on the Sanhedrin to appoint a king. You can't say that there's no mitzvah at all. You can't say that the word v'yomarta does not have some element of mitzvah, and it's only like the pasuk of v'yomarta och labasa, I want to eat v'zavachta, I want to eat meat, and therefore v'zavachta v'bakorcha, she'en o'el alav abo miklal aseh, shel olech v'lishchita, hochinami. For our purposes, this is really all we need. What he says is, the ambivalent statement, the word v'yomarta, is there because you cannot impose any kind of government on a people unless the people is ready for it. If they're ready for it, okay, then by doing so there's a fulfillment of a mitzvah. If they are not ready for it, then any other form of government that they're going to find is going to serve their purposes, is going to be not only just as good, but a great deal better. I may be leaving you with the wrong impression because I haven't said anything good about democracy. So you may walk around, and I only have about 7 or 8 minutes left. So let me tell you, knowing all of the failings and the weaknesses of democracy, and I think personally we have suffered from, and we are suffering until today from some of the weaknesses of a democracy. It's unbelievable. A man heads a party, and the entire party has voted unanimously, overwhelmingly, against the Palestinian state. And the head of that party, and he was not elected by direct elections, he was elected via the fact that we voted for his party. He goes off, and he wants to become the father of a Palestinian state. Only in a democracy can a Sharon act the way he's acting. When I voted for, if I voted for Likud, I was voting for a party that had a clear platform. And you know what I get? I get something completely different than what I voted for. So what did my democracy help me? What did my vote help me? Nothing happened. Not only nothing happened, I've been fooled. I've been cheated. It's unbelievable. I'd walk in to take out a bagatz against the prime minister. Most probably I'd end up in someplace in a dungeon beneath the Russian compound. I don't understand. And I've been there before. I don't understand. I'd like to over-dramatize it a little bit. It was a pretty dank, dark, dirty place, that's for sure. But I don't understand. This is democracy. That's not democracy. That flies in the face of anything that's democracy. But let's take number six. Number six comes from an article that was written by Rabbi Nachum Rabinovich, who is the Rav of the Yeshiva of Yeshiva in Malei Adumim. Kayom, he says, Kayom, he talks about the fact that since the Second World War, there are so many new countries that came into being. And from all of these countries, he says, you can only count three that can be defined as democracies. I don't know which the other two are. Maybe India. India? Maybe Pakistan. India? None of the others. I can't think of anything else. What else came into being since the second? Nothing in Europe. In Africa, there are no democracies. Is there one democracy in Africa? What do the Afrikaners have to say? Is there a democracy in just South Africa? But they didn't come into being after the second World War. He's talking about all the new nations that came in. Now,
כיום ניתן להגדיר כדמוקרטיות לא יותר משלוש מאותן מדינות חדשות שקמו לאחר מלחמת העולם השנייה. You can't define and describe, maybe talk of Pakistan. Or, you know, maybe nationalist China. Taiwan is a real democracy. Out of all the nations that came into being since the Second World War, only three are democracies. ורק באחת מהן בישראל הדמוקרטיה היא חיונית ואיתנה. And the place in which is full of life and strength is in Israel. What he wants to explain is the following. How did it happen? What we see in the world is that people who didn't grow up with democracy and don't have it in their genes create one dictatorship after another. From Idi Amin to who knows what else. In other words, it's not a simple thing for a people to reach a point of democracy. Here, a nation comes into being, and on its first day, it's a democracy. And not only on its first day, it's a democracy, with all of its faults, it's one of the healthiest democracies in the world. It could be a great deal healthier, and that's what we're talking about. How does it happen? There's no tradition. We haven't had a country for 2,000 years. Why is it that every fashion-looking country in the world is still fighting around to try and get some kind of government? And they're killing themselves. The world is bleeding. And here, pit'om, kam medina, and it's a democracy. And they're playing, in most cases, they're playing against the rules, except when they break the rules. And unfortunately, they break the rules on the big things. That's where they break the rules. So he says, "Hademokrati uvda zot vaday doreshet hezbe." This fact needs some kind of explanation. Veta hezbe yesh lechapes betoldot ameinu. You know where you find the? You know where you have to search for the reason that our democracy here is a healthy one? You have to look at it in the history of the Jewish people. Hademokrati higidul adin. Democracy is a very delicate growth, a very delicate little plant. Asher doresh meot shanim shel havshalav v'tipuach regishim. It needs hundreds of years in order to be raised and to grow and to be healthy. Baratzot shebhen erkei ha-demokratia v'yisodosel go through kol revadei ha-tarbut. I'll explain it in a moment. In those nations where all sorts of organizations work democratically, so democracy is within the bloodstream, and therefore it can thrive and it can grow and it can be developed and it can be perfected. But in those nations where there is no tradition. Let's use maybe it's not an extreme example. In in nations where the unit was the tribal unit. The tribal unit was never a democratic unit. It was always a melech unit, right? So they had the head of the tribe. He could have been a king. By the way, that's how the world began. The first government of the world was Nimrod, who was a king. Because people turned to somebody who seemed stronger and mightier and more powerful. And they were able to rally around him. And they really relinquished all their rights to him. That may very well be the reason why in Africa they simply have no tradition of democracy in any of their organizations, in any of their groupings. So democracy simply hasn't developed. Where democracy is some foreign idea, then it withers and dies. In order to understand its development in the state of Israel, we have to know about Hashkafas HaTorah. You know what he's going to describe? He's going to describe simply the halachas of how did the Jewish community function? In Europe, in Bavel, how did the Jewish, in Ashtetl, how did the Jewish community function? You can go through dozens of halachas in Shulchan Aruch.
where the Shulchan Aruch talks about elections for the people who will represent us in the city. In every town, in every shtetl, Jews were running their lives democratically. There wasn't somebody who walked into shul one day and say, "Ich bin der Gabbe," whether you like it or not. There was no such thing. There was a meeting of the shul, and in towns there was always a meeting of the people in town. The Shulchan Aruch even discusses who has the right to vote. How long do you have to live in the city in order to be able to vote? The Shulchan Aruch is full of all of the fundamental principles upon which democracy is based. The fact is, therefore, that democracy was so natural to Klal Yisrael because it flows straight from the halacha. It makes an interesting snide remark, and I like that snide remark, because there were those amongst us here who thought democracy is. They made a terrible mistake. What they didn't understand is because they didn't know the Jewish kehilla, the Geis Ashkenazi intellectuals from the secular Zionist world didn't have a clue how a shul functioned, how a Jewish community functioned. It was democracy, democracy all the way. For those hundreds of thousands of Jews who came from all over the world in the first years of the state, there was nothing more natural to them than democracy. Sure, they came from countries where they were dictatorships and they were kings, but that's not the way the inner Jewish community worked. Shulchan Aruch says exactly what a community has to do. A community has to build a shul, they have to build a mikveh, and they have to have a rabbi, and they have to pay him well, and they need a chazan, you know. All of these things are outlined in the Shulchan Aruch. It's all there. Jewish life for 2,000 years, and even before that, Jewish life was always based on the principle of democracy. That's why this, which could not function and hasn't functioned until today in over 100 countries in the world, it's because they're going from a tribal structure to democracy. And it's a very, very difficult change to make. It's a change in one's whole thinking. And you can't do that. But by Klal Yisrael, it was always democracy. So much is written in Shulchan Aruch. But the secular Ashkenazi so-called elite are the ones that didn't understand that because they never knew the workings of an inner community. They most probably hadn't been in a shul in 50 years and never voted in an election. And you know what? So what? So people yelled at each other in shul at the elections. They threw herring at each other. But in the final analysis, there was an election, and whoever was elected was the gabbe until the next elections. That's exactly the way it worked. So it means that halacha created the framework within which democracy can thrive, and that's exactly why it thrives here. That's exactly, does it need a great deal of further growth and development? There's no question about it. And as I say, what's most important is there have to be directly elected representatives, or at the very least, two chambers, one directly elected and one through some other way. But that there isn't a single member of Knesset who owes his job and his allegiance to a particular sector of the community is a himmelgeschrei. This is a terrible, terrible thing. These things have to be changed. The important thing is that everything flows from the Netziv, because the Netziv says your Torah never wanted to coerce any form of government on people because you can't do it. It'll never succeed. People have to be ready for a certain form of government. And therefore, he says, that's why the Torah used this word, v'omarto, that can be read in a number of ways in order not to make it something that is a divine imperative that it must be. What I haven't touched upon here, in Yetzir Hashem, the day will come. There are two major essays by Don Yitzchak Abarbanel. If you want to study something that is violently opposed to a monarchy, it's Don Yitzchak Abarbanel. His parish on this parasha and his parish is Shmuel, because remember, he lived through the worst horrors of a monarchy. He was the Secretary of the Treasury of Ferdinand and Isabella, who destroyed Spain. The Pasha destroyed Spain, but I couldn't care less about Spain. But what they did to Klal Yisrael was I didn't want to use the word Shoah, but pretty, pretty close. We talked about Girush Sfarad 2 or 3 weeks ago, Pashas Ekev, we talked about it. He saw monarchy at its worst. And therefore, that's the experience that he brought to the Pasha. So it's fascinating. Do you understand? What I find more fascinating than anything else is one word that's chosen by Torah can make all the difference in the world. One word. How careful was the choice of the word? How significant was the choice of that one word? That one word leaves open all of the possibilities so that a democracy can be Al Pi Din and it can be Al Pi Torah. And certainly we hope that it will be more Al Pi Torah. Right? That's it. That's enough.